From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our connections with it. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak. In 1953, the Swiss chemical company Ciba Geigy came to Toms River, New Jersey. By all accounts, the community welcomed the plant and its dye production, for it brought jobs and tax revenue to this small town on the Jersey shore.
The arrangement was good for Ciba Geigy, too. Its manufacturing process created large volumes of wastewater, so Ciba did what other chemical plants in the area were doing. Discharge the untreated waste into sandy holding ponds and directly into the Toms River.
That's right. Then nearly three decades later, the plant closed. 47,000 drums of chemical waste were discovered on the property. The EPA placed the site under its Superfund program, and the cases of cancer within the community, particularly among children, rose.
Dan Fagan, the director of science, health, and environmental reporting at New York University, chronicled this story and the community's fight for answers in his book, Toms River, A Story of Science and Salvation. He joins us in the first half of the show.
And in the second half of the show, we'll speak with Rachel Otto. She's the executive director of Breathe Utah, a nonprofit organization dedicated to promoting policies and awareness for clean air along the Wasatch Front.
Last week, Governor Herbert and the Department of Air Quality put forward a proposal to ban wood-burning fireplaces from November to March along the Wasatch Front.
What are the specifics of the ban? How will it be enforced? And will it apply to us up here in Summit County? Rachel Otto explains in the second half of the show.
As always, you can join in on the conversation with both of our guests today by posting your questions and comments to our Facebook page, KPCW This Green Earth.
Our connections with and impacts upon the environment. That's what This Green Earth is all about. Stay with us.
Rocky Mountain Power is proud to support KPCW and This Green Earth. Rocky Mountain Power WattSmart New Homes Program offers incentives for building a new, energy-efficient home that can help you enjoy year-round comfort, higher resale value, and lower energy bills. To learn more or find a builder in your area, WattSmart.com.
Wyndham Vacation Rentals is happy to continue our support for KPCW for the upcoming ski season. For over 30 years, our local staff has been managing rental properties throughout Park City, providing nightly rentals with a range of services and amenities for every visitor's vacation. We can be reached at 649-6606 or online at wvrparkcity.com.
Welcome to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues and concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak. She's Nell Larson across the board. In 1953, the Swiss chemical company Ciba Geigy came to Toms River, New Jersey, and by all accounts, the community was delighted to have it. The chemical plant manufactured textile dyes and brought jobs and tax revenue to the small town on the Jersey shore. Then nearly two decades after Ciba first came to town, a cancer epidemic was identified in the community. Dan Fagan is the director of science, health, and environmental reporting program at New York University, and he chronicled this story and the community's fights for answers in his book, Toms River, a Pulitzer Prize-winning book, by the way, Toms River, A Story of Science and Salvation. And Dan joins us by phone from I assume it's New York. Dan, thanks for joining Nell and myself this morning.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
Hey, Dan, let's start with some background. Basically, where is Toms River?
Toms River is about equidistant between Philadelphia and New York City on the Jersey Shore. It's more like a triangle than a line. Toms River, for a couple hundred years, was a very small town. Didn't really get much attention for anything at all, at least not since the Revolutionary War. But then the chemical industry came to town, starting in the early 50s, and things started to change.
Right, and so Ciba Geigy decides to build their plant there. And what was Ciba Geigy manufacturing?
They were making dyes, and dyes, as it turns out, are a really interesting class of industrial products for really surprising reasons. It turns out that the chemical industry that arose in the mid-19th century, the big companies that became BASF and GAF, they all began as dye manufacturing, mm-hmm. Dye manufacturers, and certainly that was true for Ciba and Geigy as well. And the other big reason that dye manufacturing is interesting and important is because it generates a tremendous amount of waste. Mm-hmm. As I show in the book, something like 6 or 7 times more, depending on the kind of dye you're making, generates 6 or 7 times more volume in toxic wastewater than in finished dye itself. So that makes the process very dirty, very difficult to do without wrecking the surrounding environment. And indeed, that's what happened, first in Europe, then in lots of other places, then in Tom's River, and now today in China.
Right, right. And we'll get to the stories that are unfolding in China a little later. So like we say in the introduction, Tom's River, like a sleepy town, by all accounts, they were happy to have Ciba Geigy because this was jobs. These were good jobs, too.
They were. They were very good jobs, you know, at least in terms of in the short run. They paid well. They were stable. They were long-term jobs. There was room to move up within the organization. So everyone was very happy to have this plant. And that did not change for a long time, even though there were indications almost immediately that there were environmental problems arising.
Okay, so let's start to turn our attention to that. That you say there's a large amount of wastewater that's generated in the process of making these dyes. Wastewater was one. Was there air pollution? Was there solid waste generated too?
Mm-hmm. Yep, all those things. There was, as I said, a tremendous amount of wastewater, most of which, you know, went straight into the groundwater system or directly into the Tom's River, which was really just a little creek
right.
at that point. You know, there was so much wastewater that there was actually more wastewater at various times than there was actual river water.
Actual river, yeah.
Imagine that. And yes, there was lots of solid waste, dump sites, unpermitted, dozens of them, all over this huge property.
Yeah,
open pit dumping, and then there was also a huge amount of air pollution, what the company sort of charmingly referred to as visual pollution, that they ultimately decided to deal with by only burning the most colorful materials at night so people would see them.
Ah, yes. I grew up in Philadelphia, Dan. I know what you're talking about. The oil refineries and chemical plants there, too, there seemed to be a lot of activity going on at night that the
yeah.
city lights would illuminate at times.
Yeah.
But that's an important point. Were there other chemical companies around this area with Ciba Geigy? Were they
yeah.
all, in effect, contributing to the same, generating similar waste streams?
Yeah, that's a really crucial question that I address in the book. And the answer is, of course, there were lots of other places. New Jersey was the center of American chemical industry and post-war American chemical industry. It isn't anymore. So especially northern New Jersey, there were all kinds of major polluters. Ciba, in some ways, was worse, especially in the way that it handled solid and liquid waste. It did not keep up with the state-of-the-art technology. So in some ways it was worse. And the other thing is that eventually there's another big problem that happened in Tom's River, and that was there was a horrendous illegal dumping incident where a couple of thousand barrels of corroded barrels of chemical waste was dumped in the back of a chicken farm, and that ultimately contaminated more water wells, different set of wells that had been contaminated initially by Ciba. So there were lots of things going on, and yeah, that's part of the difficulty of trying to figure out what happened when
right.
people get sick, is trying to figure out who to blame can be a very complex process.
Right, right. And at the same time, this is in the 50s and 60s and even in the 70s, what was the environmental regulations, the environmental responsibilities for these mm-hmm. companies?
Well, That's a complicated question. It depends on exactly what you're talking about and when. SIBO was ultimately prosecuted twice. The cases were ultimately resolved each time. In one case, a few people were convicted. But generally speaking, the rules were much more lax back then. They were certainly subject to broad interpretation.
Right.
And the state of New Jersey's general interpretation up through the 1980s tended to be very pro-industry.
Yeah, so in effect, was SIBO breaking any regulations, any protocols or standards by discharging their wastewater into the Toms River?
Right. The simple answer is, you know, it depends on exactly which year you're talking about and which activity. There was a big piece of litigation between SIBO and its insurance companies, which thought that they shouldn't have to pay to clean up such outrageous behavior by the company. And SIBO actually won that litigation, at least as far as practices in the 50s and 60s. And the trial judge determined that what SIBO was doing was consistent with industry standards. On the other hand, in the 70s and the 80s, the company got in a lot of trouble for all sorts of sins, including burying hazardous waste in a landfill that was supposed to be for non-hazardous waste only.
Right. And as I was reading through the EPA, some of the reports of the EPA, and they eventually discovered somewhere around 47,000 drums. These are 55-gallon drums buried on the property. Full of sludge, other solid waste material.
Mm-hmm.
And that obviously probably contributed to the problem, because eventually the groundwater, in addition to the Toms River getting contaminated and whatever environmental impacts there were associated with that, the groundwater was impacted, and this led to drinking water impacts?
It did. As early as, you know, the mid-1950s, when the plant was only a couple years old, the company, you know, had contaminated its own drinking water wells. So factory workers knew not to use the water fountains on site. The company's response was to drill wells in a different place, but not to correct the fundamental pollution of the groundwater.
Mm-hmm.
So that groundwater reached the river, and that river in turn was sort of sucked up by water wells downstream. That would just sort of suck up the water through the porous riverbank and distribute it all over town. So people who worked at the factory then started to get that familiar taste in the water at their homes. They were disturbed, but fundamentally nothing changed. SIBO did SIBO's big answer was to build a giant pipeline to the ocean to channel a significant amount of that waste into the ocean. That did not solve the fundamental problem. The waste was just moved to a different place. And also it did nothing about the groundwater that was already contaminated on site. So that's what happened. Essentially, this waste was distributed via the drinking water system all over town. And it wasn't just SIBO's waste. It was also from this illegal dumping at Reich Farm, at the old chicken farm. In some ways, the waste from that dumping was really much more damaging and was implicated much more strongly in the cancer cluster that was detected later.
If you just join us, we're speaking with Dan Fagan. He's the author of the Pulitzer Prize winning book, Toms River, A Story of Science and Salvation. I just tell our listeners, I apologize if you haven't heard our co-host, Nell Larson, yet. We're having some technical difficulties with her mic. She usually has all the intelligent questions, Dan, so you'll have to put up with my questions so far. But so that's the setting and the background. Eventually the groundwater is contaminated, the drinking water gets contaminated, and now let's turn to some of the consequences with respect to human health. There seem to be a growing number of, or what seemed to be the perception of a growing number of cancers in the Toms River area, particularly in the with respect to childhood types of cancer rates, correct?
Yeah, that's right. A number of people, led by a woman named Linda Gillick, whose son was diagnosed with neuroblastoma when he was only a few months old, began to notice that there seemed to be a lot of kids in Toms River who had cancer. I mean, Linda in particular noticed, because there was no pediatric oncology ward, no hospital with a childhood cancer ward in Toms River at that point. Toms River was too small for that. Mm-hmm. So she would go to Philadelphia and to New York City to these big hospitals that would get patients from all over the world and certainly all over the region. And yet whenever she went, she would hear about another family from Toms River. So she started keeping track of these cases, and other people did too. They started to notice. They brought that to the attention of the state health department. A nurse at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia talked to physicians on her ward about it, and they were repeatedly told, "Don't worry about it. This is nothing. Clusters appear for random reasons," which is true, by the way.
Yeah,
you know, some things cluster sometimes for no reason at all, other than bad luck. And, you know, that, again, is a critical difficulty of these cluster investigations, but also in my mind, what makes them so fascinating. I mean, what I try to describe in this book is a scientific detective story, a real-world, real-life detective story with lots of twists and turns along the way, you know, as well as compelling characters. And I think that's why the book ultimately has sort of broken out of just the science sphere and it has found a much larger audience, which I'm really happy about.
Yeah, well, it's like that CSI, Toms River, CSI Ciba-Geigy in that sense. But what kind of differences were we seeing in Toms River compared to the rest of New Jersey? Was it a dramatic change or rates of cancer, or is it subtle, or is it?
Well, it's subtle, and the reason is because childhood cancer is a rare disease. Actually, cancer isn't a disease at all. It's a collection of sometimes only loosely connected, you know, 150 plus diagnoses. But even if you aggregate all those cancers together, children don't get cancer very often. When they do get cancer, people notice. So ultimately, what the state found when it looked at a sort of a whole different series of sort of aggregations of types of cancer was that for every aggregation they looked at, every type of cancer they looked at, every family of cancers, let's say, that they looked at, they found significantly more cases than would be expected, sometimes 4, 5, 7, 8 times as much cancer as would be expected. On the other hand, it was still a relatively small number of cases.
Mm-hmm.
You know, ultimately, in terms of the number of families that became part of the legal settlement in Toms River, it was only about 70 kids. So, and that was over, you know, a long period of time, 20-plus year period of time. So that, again, is what makes this so difficult. It's a little bit like trying to figure out who's going to be president based on an opinion poll in which you only poll a dozen people. You're going to get an interesting result, but you can't be sure that your result is likely to reflect the reality of the broader electorate. We know opinion polls are reliable if they have a relatively small margin of error. You know, if you poll 1,000-plus people nationally and you pick those people the correct way, you're going to get a pretty reliable result. But with childhood cancer in a specific community, especially if it's a small community, the margins of error are going to be quite large, and that's one of the things that makes this so difficult.
So once people started to notice this happening, where did it go from there? What were the next steps?
Well, a number of different things happened. I mean, the obvious place that people go is to their state health department. Every state health department is to some extent responsible for this and, you know, responsible for responding to, you know, people's concerns about what they see in their neighborhoods. Sometimes people contact their county health department initially, but then those cases will inevitably get referred to the state and occasionally to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta. So that happened here, and there were repeated complaints to the state, which were mostly blown off. And then ultimately, when the state did its sort of first real investigation, a kind of a statistical snapshot that determined that rates really were higher, much higher in Toms River across the board for kids than would be expected based on the demographics of the town. That was done by the State Health Department and came as a result of a complaint from a very brave and compassionate nurse at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia.
Right.
So that happened, but even then things didn't really go very far because the state ultimately, you know, after concluding that rates were much higher than expected, the state investigators' conclusion was that, well, the number of cases was so small that there's really nothing that we could do about this. There's no next step we could take. So they things sort of stopped, and they would have stopped forever, except that the word of the state's conclusions leaked out and ultimately was the subject of a screaming headline in the largest newspaper in the state. And that unleashed pandemonium in Toms River and ultimately led to many millions of dollars being spent on a truly comprehensive environmental study that ultimately found that there were indeed statistically significant, scientifically legitimate links, an association between exposure to contaminated air in Toms River and contaminated wells, a certain set of wells in Toms River
right.
that were contaminated from Reich Farm. There were statistically significant associations with childhood leukemia among girls. And that was an astonishing result because for all the statistically difficult reasons that I explained earlier, these studies almost never find a scientifically legitimate conclusion, a scientifically legitimate association. And yet, in this case, they did.
And one other interesting thing I think you write about is that fact that once the plant closed or discontinued some of these practices and the groundwater treatment systems were put in place or drinking water treatment systems were placed, did these cancer rates drop?
They did. You know, and again, any legitimate scientist would tell you that's a correlative
yeah.
relationship. It's a correlation, not a causative. Tells you nothing about whether A caused B. It only tells you that A and B happened at the same time.
Right.
And so that's encouraging. It doesn't prove anything. But really a big message of my book is that we have to get past this idea of proof, and we have to instead think about likelihood. Epidemiology, which is an often abused and insulted science because it's not about proof, it's about likelihood. Epidemiology has saved millions of lives in this world, and I explain how that has happened in a lot of the history that I explain in this book. So really, we need to exercise a little more common sense and look at environmental problems not as criminal cases where we need proof beyond a reasonable doubt, but instead more like we would think about with civil cases, you know, where a preponderance of the evidence is the standard for conviction. Really, that's what we're talking about when we're talking about environmental health. We're talking about weighing the evidence, not looking for smoking gun proof.
Right.
So is this, you know, a story that you've seen many times over throughout the United States, this Toms River sort of scenario, or
yeah.
is this unique to this site?
Well, both things are true, I think. Toms River is unique in a sense, almost unique in a sense that a really sophisticated, elaborate piece of science was done. And that happened only because the residents raised a lot of hell, and they had access to political power due to some really unique circumstances that were happening in New Jersey at that time. So we don't really know how unusual Toms River-style cancer clusters are because no one is really looking for them. It's simple statistical analysis would tell you that there are lots of these clusters around. But we don't know that for sure because we don't do proactive surveillance. Instead, the only time we really hear about clusters are when people notice them and then are sufficiently stubborn and determined and sometimes even obnoxious in their pursuit of trying to get real scientific information about what's behind the cluster. So it's really hard to say.
Yeah.
In some ways, what's most unusual about Tom's River is not that there was egregious pollution followed by an egregious cancer cluster. What's most unusual about Tom's River is that we actually heard about it. And that only happened due to a series of really unlikely, kind of amazing events that I explain in the book.
Right, including the power of the press sometimes, right, Dan?
Sometimes, yeah.
Yeah. You're listening to This Green Earth on KPCW, and we're speaking with Dan Fagan. He's the author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Tom's River, A Story of Science and Salvation. Dan, we got a few more minutes. Continuing on that conversation, where are scenarios like this unfolding now? The regulations here in this country have, at least for now, have kind of tightened up and have hopefully preventing situations like this from occurring. But we've also kind of exported our pollution in some ways.
We have. We've outsourced our pollution.
Yeah.
Just as we've outsourced our, carbon emissions too. You know, we're feeling very confident these days and proud that China is, that we're no longer the biggest carbon emitter, just as we're no longer the biggest chemical manufacturer. But really, that's misleading, because the reason that China has passed us is simply because the products that we keep consuming are now more likely to be manufactured in China than they are in the United States. So, yes, I end the book going to China, visiting the cancer ward, the oncology ward at the Children's Hospital in Chongqing, which is a very large regional city in western China. And, you know, what I found when I got there are a lot of physicians and families and kids who are very concerned about environmental exposures, very concerned about the fact that there are so many pediatric leukemias and central nervous system cancer cases. And there's a lot of anxiety about that. And there are also a lot of people who are doing what Linda Gillick did. They're trying to make maps. They're trying to chart what's happening in their neighborhoods to try to make sense of it. And it's an extremely difficult process. And what I hope that will happen as a result of this book, and lots of other people who are making similar efforts, is that people in China and then the countries that will follow, Indonesia, Africa, wherever the chemical industry moves next, that people will learn from the mistakes that have been made in Europe and North America. And I hope my book will be part of that process, and I'm very glad that the book is going to be published in Chinese.
Great.
Starting next year.
So before we wrap up, I want to ask, what is, the setting in Tom's River now? Mm-hmm. Is this still a big issue? Mm-hmm. What does this site look like?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked me about that, because I wouldn't want readers to have the impression that Tom's River is some kind of a current environmental disaster, because it isn't at all. The water is now properly filtered. The factory is long gone. The groundwater beneath the two sites is still being pumped and treated, and will be for another 15 years or so. But there's really no reason at all to think that the air and water in Tom's River is any worse than in lots of other suburban, semi-industrialized areas in North America and Europe. So people shouldn't have that misimpression. What's really most significant about Tom's River is that, in my view, it can happen anywhere. It happened here. We happen to notice it here, but it could and probably is happening in many other places.
Well, like I said, Dan, I grew up in southern New Jersey, and so there were a number of Superfund sites around me, and I saw some of my friends in the 20s and 30s who contracted non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And so it just seemed odd. Was it, you know, like you say, is that a coincidence? Is it just happened that I just happened to know four guys who were my age in their 20s and 30s contract cancer like this, and two of them passed away? But I knew 97 other guys who were my age who didn't have it. And that's the challenge with trying to identify whether or not there's a connection between a cause and an impact like that.
It is. It's hard enough to identify whether a cluster is just coincidental or has some cause. And then taking that next step and trying to identify the specific cause is incredibly difficult, even more difficult. So it's a really difficult problem, but it is not an impossible problem.
Right.
And all it takes is determination and money. And that's what was brought to bear in Toms River due to some really unlikely, fascinating circumstances. And that's the story that I tell in this book.
Well, the name of the book is Toms River, A Story of Science and Salvation. Dan Fagan is the author. Dan, you got a website we can go to and learn more about you?
You can learn much more about the book at danfagan.com, danfagin.com.
Perfect. Thanks again, Dan, for joining us on This Green Earth.
Nice to be with you.
All right. Hey, let's take a break for a couple of sponsors and underwriters. And when we come back, we'll be speaking with Rachel Otto of Breathe Utah. It's This Green Earth. Stay tuned.
Hi, I'm Maren Mullen, and I'm a Recycle Utah board member. Did you know that water conservation is what we're really all about? And you thought it was only recycling. We save your H2O. How? By encouraging you to recycle more, by teaching our students how to conserve water, and by making it possible for you to drop off hazardous waste at our collection events. Yep, we're all about saving your water, because we can't live without it. Recycle Utah is a nonprofit organization bringing conservation ideas to you since 1990. Check us out at recycleutah.org.
'Twas the month of Christmas, and all through Park City was our support for KPCW and the smell of boughs emanating from Park City Nursery. We've been a tradition since 1983 with Christmas trees, wreaths, and garlands of all sizes. Also offering our wreaths for shipping to family and friends online at parkcitynursery.com.
This is Alyssa Daly with Republic Services, sponsor of This Green Earth on KPCW. During the holiday season, Americans discard 25% more trash than normal. 80% of what is discarded during the holidays could be recycled, from gift boxes to wrapping paper and holiday cards. Recycling during the holiday season helps keep Summit County clean.
Welcome back to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues and concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak. Nell Larson is always across the board. And joining us in the studio is Rachel Otto. She's the executive director of Breathe Utah, an advocacy group, environmental advocacy group that focuses on air quality and air issues and along the Wasatch Front, correct, Rachel?
Mostly correct.
Okay.
Thanks for having me.
All right, you fill in the rest. Yeah.
Thank you very much for having me up here. Everything you said was correct, except for that we focus on air quality advocacy and education across Utah, not just in the Wasatch Front.
All right. So that would include us.
It does include you.
Perfect, because we could use it. Perhaps.
I know, because you're getting left out of this wood burning issue. So,
and we'll get to that in a second about how it might impact or not impact us up here. But let's talk about this. Last week, or now two weeks ago, the governor announced that they're considering a ban on wood burning fireplaces or wood-burning systems, correct?
That's right. The governor has requested the Air Quality Board to consider a new rule that would basically enact a season-long ban on solid fuel-burning devices. So for the entire inversion season from November 15th through March for the non-attainment counties. So it's only for select counties that don't typically meet the health quality standards for PM2.5.
So that's something that I haven't seen covered much in the news. Chris and I were actually talking about this. It's hard to find details about this proposed ban. So tell us, you know, what these non-attainment communities are and also what some of the other exceptions are.
Okay, so there are seven areas in Utah that are typically out of compliance with the federal health quality regulations on particulate matter. And those counties or parts of counties are Box Elder, Cache, Davis, Salt Lake, Tooele, Utah, and Weber. So those seven areas would be subject to this ban, and they would be prevented from burning all season long, not just on action days or red air days.
Right, that's important, because right now, what is the standards that with respect to, say, fireplaces, wood-burning fireplaces down there?
In all of these areas, you can burn wood or coal or whatever solid fuel you want on green or sometimes even in yellow days at this point, except in Salt Lake County, that may change. So this would stop any wood burning for the entire or coal burning for the entire season.
Whether it's a green or a day, or whether it's a bluebird day, or no inversion, no inversion. Just no more fireplaces. I keep saying fire, but as an example, there's other wood burning devices, stoves, like you say, or so. But this would be all. I couldn't burn a have a fire.
No, you couldn't. Except. There are a few exceptions.
Okay. Yeah.
the exemptions are areas of those counties, or some proposed exemptions, I should say, since this is just a proposed rule thus far. The proposed exemptions are some areas that are over 7,000 feet in those counties, and the sole source homeowners. There are a number of people who are registered with the Division of Air Quality who are called sole source homeowners, and those are people who rely only on wood or coal for heat. They don't have any other source of heat. They would be exempted. And then commercial or wood boilers that are otherwise permitted by the state would be exempted. Restaurants would be exempted. So your wood-fired pizza places and things like that would be exempted as well.
So before we go too deep into this, I want to talk a little bit about why this kind of ban is important, I guess. And there, in my mind, there are kind of two aspects. One is, yes, our general air quality and the inversion, but there's also a really strong connection with personal health impacts. So can you talk a little bit about why you guys have been advocating for this?
Well, you've said it. I mean, essentially, while we certainly care about, you know, meeting the federal air quality standards, what this really is a public health issue. And you know, as we have come to find out through more research on this topic, even if it is a green air day, if you or your neighbor has a wood fire going, it's not a green air day for you. So up to 60 to 70% of the particulates from a wood fire will stay in your home and can even be blown into your neighbor's home through doors, through windows, through closed doors, through closed windows, I should
say.
So this is it's a serious public health issue. So green air day or no green air day, if there's a wood or coal fire going, you know, you're inhaling a lot of particulate matter that's lodging deep in your lungs and can be carcinogenic and cause genetic mutations over time, things like that. So it's a big issue.
And there are some surprising impacts that you wouldn't normally associate. You think particulates, you think lungs, but I've read, you know, blood pressure, internal organs. So talk a little bit more about these impacts.
Yeah, so research, there's a lot of interesting research going on at the University of Utah right now about different health impacts. And it's not just, you know, your lungs. It is your heart, your whole circulatory system that can be affected. So if you want to get really scientific about it, you can look at all of these neat papers that the University of Utah researchers are putting out. And it's not just people with respiratory issues or pulmonary issues that need to be concerned about this. It's young children, it's elderly people, it's really everybody, unless you want to inhale, you know, a large number of particulates because you stopped smoking and you really miss inhaling a lot of particulates.
Right.
So it's bad for you.
Okay. Well, I got a question from a listener who wants to know, would this include grills, charcoal-fired grills during that winter time period?
I think it would, under the proposed rule, yes. If it's at your house,
yeah,
as an individual, In a non-attainment area, yes, it would
so
include...
So I couldn't use my grill.
You could not use your charcoal grill.
Charcoal grill.
You can use your gas grill.
Gas grill, sure. Okay. Well, okay, so Rachel, here's the challenge. I see a couple of challenges here.
First, if only there was just one challenge, we'd be right. in shape.
No, but I mean, obviously the biggest challenge is trying to enforce this thing, right? Because you're telling people, hey, I like my fireplace. Mm-hmm. My fireplace isn't a source of heat. It doesn't heat my own. In fact, it probably draws cold air into the home. You know, it's that inefficient. But I like to have a fire, a wood-burning fire, because of the aesthetics, right? It looks great. It smells, let's be honest, you know,
it's
smells
cozy.
Good. It's right. There's an ambiance associated with that. And now we're telling people, no, we really prefer that you not do that. But that smacks of nanny statism, if I've ever heard it. I'm sure you've heard some of those,
yeah.
that pushback.
Sure, I definitely understand that point of view. But you know, I think what we need to think about is in the recent Envision Utah survey of Utahns, air quality is the number one issue for most Utahns, particularly Utahns in urban areas. And 99% of those people say that they are willing to take some kind of individual action to help the air quality. This is an individual action that people can take. It's easy, it's low-hanging fruit, basically. Is it going to solve our air quality problems? No, but it does, being that particular pollution and particular pollution from wood fires is a huge part of our wintertime inversion problem. This will help, and
yeah.
it will certainly help your local air quality.
Okay.
So is there any data on, you know, what percent or approximate percent of the air quality issue is caused by
right.
wood-burning stoves or fireplaces?
So some local research has come up with some pretty surprising numbers that it's up to 10% of our wintertime particulate pollution comes from wood-burning sources. Now, we can't distinguish between cooking fires and, you know, your fireplace set in your cabin, but we do know that a significant portion comes from wood and coal.
Okay.
And what are the other major sources?
Well, vehicles.
Yeah.
Is the other major source.
Right.
And then the second major source is really our homes, our businesses, those kinds of area sources that are, you know, polluting, even though we don't necessarily think of our homes as major polluters, they are. So all of us in the aggregate, particularly with increased growth across the Wasatch Front and up here too, will be creating more and more of a air quality problem.
Okay. I want to get to what how it might impact us up here, but any sense of how many fireplaces we're talking about down along the Wasatch Front in those counties?
No.
Thousands, ten thousands?
No, it's a good question, and I don't know the answer to
right.
that. We do know that currently there are about 200 people on the sole source registry list, that list that you have to be on to be exempt from no burning
yeah.
regulations. And that list under this proposed rule would be reopened until June 15th of next year for more people to get on the list, because we've found that, or we suspect that there are many people who actually do rely on wood that are not on the list.
Really?
Yes.
Okay.
So would there be options for those sole source people, or people for whom maybe it's not the sole source, but it's a supplemental source, to transition to maybe like a gas fireplace or propane heat?
Yeah, one of our major concerns is Breathe Utah, and I know just many people's major concern is that natural gas is expensive, and it could be cost prohibitive for a certain number of people. And so we're very concerned about that disproportionate impact on people who may not be able to afford natural gas for the season, or rely on burning some wood to allay those gas bills. So if people are a sole source user, the state now has a great deal of money to help people convert to natural gas furnaces. And the state also has some programs for people who would qualify that would help them pay their gas bills over the wintertime.
Okay. We're speaking with Rachel Otto. She's the executive director of Breathe Utah, an advocacy group that is out to educate and hope promote changes in policies with respect to air quality issues around the state. Across the state of Utah. So we got a few more minutes. Let's talk about we talked about some exempt areas, you say above 7,000 feet. How would that impact us here in Summit County?
Well, the air
quality... Can I still have my fire?
You certainly can. You can. Okay. And now, nonetheless, if you do care about public health and the health of yourself and your neighbors, we still would recommend that you don't.
Yeah. I don't have a fireplace. I say the royal eye. I replaced my fireplace with a natural gas system, and that's great because that actually does throw heat.
Yeah.
But...
And those, it takes care of a certain amount of that ambiance piece.
Sort of.
Sort of. It's,
yeah. Yes, you're right. There's
a nice warm glow.
Yeah, but more boy, it actually heats my home, whereas the old wood-burning fireplace, like I say, was so inefficient. When I lit a fire, it would actually draw cold air in the home. But up here, we can still burn, use our wood-burning fireplaces.
Yeah, it's not against the law up here.
Okay.
Again, for public health reasons and for the health of yourself and your neighbors, you should think twice unless you really have to rely on it.
Right. And like down there, restaurants are exempt and other resorts are exempt, et cetera. Okay. And that's not going to change.
Not under this proposed rule. No.
Okay.
So what are the next steps for this proposed bill? And, you know, what should we expect to see as far as the timeline?
The proposed rule will open up for public comment starting on January 1st and will be open for public comment for 40 days. And the Air Quality Board, I know, is very interested in hearing from people in all of the affected places. So they will be holding public hearings in each of the affected areas during that 40-day period. So there's a list of public hearings in each of those locations on the Division of Air Quality's website. With dates and times. So those start, I think, on January 15th in Tooele.
Right. So this is something that wouldn't even be launched formally until next year.
Right. Oh, and I should say that if you can't make it to the public hearing, the Air Quality Board considers online and written submissions with equal weight. So submit comments regardless of whether or not you can make it to an actual meeting. And then, yes, the Air Quality Board will consider the proposed rule and go from there. So the earliest this would be enacted would be next inversion season, November.
Okay. Have we had any inversions yet? Rachel, you live down there, right?
I do. I live in Sugar House in the thick of it.
So, okay.
So we have had a couple moderate days. No red days yet, but...
But the real season is in January, starting around now and going through January from the data I've seen. January is kind of the heart of the season through February.
Typically.
Well, we got a couple more minutes. How did you get involved? What's your background? Why did you get involved in Breathe Utah?
Well, I am an attorney, and when I moved to Utah, I had no inkling that people in the United States lived in such poor air quality. And when I moved here from the East Coast, from Washington, D.C., and Cincinnati, I was just shocked that... Hmm. People lived in a place where it was recommended that their kids didn't go outside.
Right.
So I got interested in air quality, was always interested in environmental issues, but realized that air quality here is really the most pressing environmental and justice issue.
Okay. So you're just a citizen, a normal citizen, getting involved, activist. Once again, an example of grassroots efforts, whether it's Breathe Utah, or Utah Moms for Clean Air, or Utah Physicians for a Healthy Environment, and so many other grassroots organizations that have started up just within the last 5, 7, 8 years here. Many of them focused on the air issues, but we have lots of other groups, and that's how you get involved. And so if our listeners are interested in getting involved in Breathe Utah, what do they do?
Certainly go to our website, breatheutah.org, and... We really focus on education programs. Mm-hmm. So if you'd like Breathe Utah to come talk to your school or your community group about air quality or individual actions that you can take, go to our website, send us a message, and we'd be happy to come do some education.
And do you direct people from your website to locations where they can, you know, give feedback online and things like that?
Yes.
Great. Okay. And it's a great website, by the way. You've got lots of information there on, it's well-sourced, it's well-cited, a lot of science there with respect to why this is, with respect to just wood burning, why that's an issue and what are the potential health impacts. It's a really nice site.
Thank you. Yes, we like to make sure that we're providing the public with accurate information.
So okay.
As you said, there are a lot of groups out there, so there's a lot of information.
And if people want to learn more about this proposal... Where's a good site for them to go to? Is it posted on your site?
No, but I can make it posted
on
my site.
Make that happen, Rachel.
Sounds like
Rachel.
I better. Done.
Now that I've said it, the power of the press. Oh, there we are, once we in. That would be great because that's the draft proposal. And again, this is put forward by the governor, Republican governor, and this is I thought this was really a pleasant surprise.
It's really great. We're really, really excited that the governor is taking this action.
Okay. And now that we're in inversion season, this is usually when, you know, it draws their attention or their phone calls go up, as one politician tells it. Their phone calls go up. And that's one thing the politicians have said. You know, we pay attention to who contacts us, who communicates with us. And when our phones are ringing, it gets our attention.
That's right. So keep up the pressure.
All right. Again, Rachel Otto, she's the executive director with Breathe Utah. Learn more by going to breatheutah.org. Rachel, thanks again for joining us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
All right. Hey, let's take another break for a couple of sponsors and underwriters. And when we come back, we got one news item and time to wrap up.
That's right.
All right. It's This Green Earth. Stay tuned.
Hi, this is Cindy Kaiser. I want to take this opportunity to thank all of our loyal supporters throughout the year. There's still time to support local journalism. Make your tax-deductible gift online at kpcw.org or call me at 649-9004. Thank you and wishing you the best this holiday season.
This is Steve Roney with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties, formerly Prudential Utah. We continue to be proud supporters of KPCW and are excited to embark on the next era of Park City real estate under our new brand. More info at bhhsutah.com.
This is Dana Edwards on behalf of Vail Resorts and Cannons Resort supporting KPCW. This year, we developed partnerships with 25 local nonprofits to support programs like the fourth grade program at Swanner Preserve and Eco Center. Every fourth grader in Summit County will experience Utah's ecosystem firsthand and see science come to life through infield classes. Thanks to Swanner for making science cool.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Park City Nursery. We know what grows. ParkCityNursery.com. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. We are here to wrap up another week's show. So we want to thank the guests that we had in the studio today. Rachel Otto, the director of Breathe Utah, talking about the new proposed wood-burning ban.
That is really interesting. I'll be really interested to see how those public hearings unfold beginning in January. There won't be any up here, but we can certainly follow them down from off of the Department of Air Quality's websites or so.
Absolutely.
Post meeting minutes and such. And then Dan Fagan, he's the author of Tom's River, A Story of Science and Salvation. The Pulitzer Prize winning book, by the way. Get it. Read it. It's a really great story.
If you need any more convincing to get this book, hop online and read some of the reviews. Yeah. There are rave reviews out there.
Of course, I watched him on C-SPAN. They did an interview with him on C-SPAN. That was great, too. So thanks again to Dan Fagan for joining us. And of course, let's thank our underwriters and or sponsors, as always, who make this show possible. They include Recycle Utah,
Republic Services,
Vail Resorts,
San Francisco Design,
and Berkshire Hathaway Home Services.
That's right.
You can join us on Facebook, like us there, and send us your comments at KPCW, This Green Earth.
And you can always email us your thoughts, requests for future shows, comments, ideas at thisgreenearth@kpcw.org. And we'll see your email and try to get a guest on to talk about it.
Join us next week. Nell, unfortunately, will be away on assignment.
Yes, on holiday assignment.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you're going to miss our big guest.
I know.
Brian McInerney is going to be here.
You just love.
It's not a coincidence.
Yeah, to have Ryan every time I leave.
Hey, we got to go. Remember, this is KPCW Park City.
Only in Park City, only on KPZW.